This is 4:55 on Friday, August 23rd. Okay, good morning. Did I say something last time about reminding me to start this?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. So I did remember today. Okay, I want to check a few things having to do with attendance. James Boatman, Young Chan, Alex Gerber, Amir Masoodi, Trung Nguyen, Tru Yen Nguyen, Prabal Pudel, Nick Shepard, Adam Thompson. Thank you. And please do sign in on the attendance system. Still trying to figure out who's really going to be here and who's not. So having everybody signed in is helpful. Okay, any questions from last time? We'll talk about the assignment later, but I think we'll just proceed from where we were. So I think this is where we ended last time, and we had talked about different kinds of radio links. So we're going to move on from the links now to the network. What's going on inside a computer data network? And there are a variety of approaches to building networks that, again, we're going to go into in much more detail later, but sort of big picture overview at this point. So. Inside the network, we talked about there being routers, and there are two approaches. This is the first one, so-called packet switching. What we talked about last time, remember we talked about the messages associated with a video or a website or whatever being chopped up into sort of smallish 1500 byte packets, and that's how the internet works. So internet routers deal with these things called packets. Each packet is treated individually. It has its destination as part of the data of the packet, and the routers inside the network will look at those packets and say, where is it going? Where should I send this one? On a one-by-one basis. So as you think about sort of how you would implement that, you realize that the most straightforward way, at least, is to think of those packets as completely arriving at each router before you start sending them on to the rest of the world. And that's what's called store and forward routing. It isn't so much that you store them for a long time, but at least you accumulate the input completely before you start sending out. Our formulas that we've talked about before come into play here, and I think there's a problem in the problem set that's going to sort of force you to think about this more carefully. But L, the length of the packet, and R, the rate of the link, determine together the amount of time that it takes to send a packet on a link. And when you think about store and forward, that means that as you go through one of these networks, you're going to just be adding up the amount of time that it takes to send on each link. So 2L over R, assuming in this case that we have two links at both at the same speed. Okay, so you'll get to play with the implications of that in the problem set. The next thing that happens in networks is what's called queuing. So suppose that you have at some point in a system more work to do than you're able to do in a given amount of time, in the amount of time up to now. Then you're going to form a line, and we're all used to this in the grocery store, at the bank, for the bus. You know, the amount of work that an agent can do is limited by the rate at which it goes, and if there's more work showing up, then a line forms. And that, the word for that is queuing. And the implications of queuing are twofold. First of all, it makes things wait longer. So the amount of time that it takes a packet to go from source to destination increases with the amount of queuing that's involved. And the queuing can happen at each stage of the way, so it can become quite significant. And the other thing that happens because of queuing is that queues are made up of memory. At least historically, memory was expensive. And so you only had a finite amount of it in order to store the packets while waiting for the queues. Now, in recent years, memory has gotten so cheap that people build very big queues into switches and routers. And it turns out that that has actually caused a completely different set of problems. The internet was designed sort of with the idea in mind that queues would be smallish, and that because they were smallish, there would be packet drops, and that those packet drops are actually used to signal to the edges of the network that the network is too busy. And what has happened in recent years with huge queues inside the networks is that packets don't get lost, they just get delayed for longer and longer periods of time. There's lots of congestion in the network, and nobody notices. And so the network just slows down. So that's a story for an in-depth exploration later when we talk about network behavior. But anyway, queuing is, the server can't go fast enough, so you form a line. Here's an important terminological distinction that we need to get clear. And these authors are really good about this, making this clear. There are two related activities that go on in the network core. One is a packet arrives, and you have to decide quickly for that packet which outgoing link to send it on. That's called forwarding. Okay? Makes sense. There's a supporting process that goes on that provides the data that's used in the forwarding decisions. Right? And so a decision about where a packet should go on its way next step to a destination is something that has to be made for that packet sort of lickety-split right away. But what that decision is not going to change very often. And so the routing algorithms sort of monitor the state of the network as a whole and say, what would be the best decision for getting to that destination? And that happens at a much slower rate, maybe a few times a minute, whereas the packets are going to be forwarded at the rate of thousands or even millions per second. All right? So routing is the process by which you build the data structures that are used to make the decisions at the forwarding scale. And that's you could easily confuse those two words if you sort of thought about them with their English names, right? Their English dictionary definitions. But technically, this is what we mean. Okay, so we've talked about the internet and we've talked about packet switching. The world of networking actually sort of comes out partly of the telephone tradition, as invented by Alexander Graham Bell in the 1880s, and it doesn't look anything like packet switching. It uses a technique called circuit switching. And if you think about, how many people have read about sort of the history of the telephone at some point in your life? Okay, so what happens with a telephone of the 1880s to 1980s variety is that when you pick up a telephone, an electrical circuit is completed, and you dial some numbers. That first electrical circuit is just to your local central office. You dial in some numbers, and that causes relays or transistors to do things that end up making an electrical circuit all the way from your phone to the phone at the other end. Okay? So that when you talk on the telephone, you know, you're making the voltages vary on the wire, and those voltages vary at the other end in synchrony with that. And so circuit switching as a data networking technique is like that. You end up with something that either physically amounts to a circuit like that, or at least logically amounts to a circuit like that. And so here in this example, the guy here is sending. The bits that he sends maybe can be reflected immediately on the output of each switch. So the delay through this network does not incur that store and forward cost, but instead sort of everything is going on all at once as if there were really a circuit there. The good thing about circuit switching is that it gives guaranteed performance, right? Because the resources that you need to make this connection are always there. As soon as you make the connection, those resources are yours. When you wiggle bits, they wiggle at the other end in synchrony. The problem with circuit switching is that it's wasteful of resources, because it in a lot of situations, we don't actually want to be sending constantly to the guy at the other end. We're sending bursty traffic, and when we're not sending, then those resources are still reserved for our traffic and not able to be used. So circuit switching has advantages and disadvantages over packet switching. The telephone companies in the 1990s thought that there would be so much demand for sort of guaranteed circuit-like performance that they would start building networking using what amounted to circuit switching, or at least virtual circuit switching techniques. And they thought this would be required for voice, and they thought it would be especially required for video. Well, the packet switching networks have gotten so much capacity in them now that even though you're having to share that capacity among things like voice and video, it works pretty well. I say pretty well. You know, the experience of talking on a cell phone is still not quite of the quality that us old geezers had come to expect from the circuit-switched telephone network. But it's good enough, and it has lots of other advantages, such as mobility, Okay, so approaches to circuit switching. So the deal with circuit switching is that you essentially have to come up with a dedicated channel between the sender and the receiver. And that channel can be a physical wire, but it can also be a sort of virtual circuit in which we carve up the single wire into multiple virtual or logical wires. And that carving up can happen according to two different schemes called frequency division multiplexing and time division multiplexing. And let's see. So with frequency division multiplexing, it's sort of like having a lot of people in the same room all talking at the same time. How do you distinguish voices? I mean, suppose I set you guys all to have conversations with each other, with your neighbors, and you'd all be talking at the same time, and yet you'd all be able to understand the conversation that was going on mostly, right? if it gets too noisy, then you can't, but you can, because different people's voices have different pitches, right? And so you can pick out the pitches of different voices from a whole lot of noise that's all going on at the same time. Same deal with frequency division multiplexing in a network. You've got a wire, but if different people send at different frequencies on that wire, you can tune your receiver to one or the other of the channels and pick out the different signals. Okay? So the other thing that people do to build virtual channels over, or logical channels over a wire, is to chop up the available time into segments and then make people send all their data in a short period of time and then let somebody else send for a short period of time. So this one goes like this. I don't know what the dashy lines mean there, but okay. So the blue sender sends really fast for a while, then he shuts up, and then again, and then again. All right. So, and in that case, he's using the available frequency bandwidth of the wire to send fast, whereas here he has to send slower, but he could send continuously. Okay. So just terminology again. Frequency division multiplexing, time division multiplexing. Okay, we can analyze the packet switching versus circuit switching issue a little bit more deeply. So again, thinking about bursty traffic with a 1 megabit per second link and everybody sending 100 kilobits per second when they're active, but only active 10% of the time, in a circuit switching arrangement, you'd only be able to support 10 users. Why? Because you have a megabit per second, and each user, when active, uses a tenth of that. So, 10 users. Packet switching, it's probabilistic, right? Everybody sort of sends when they want to. If they're active a specific 10% of the time on a regular schedule, this won't work so well. But if they're sort of on average active 10% of the time, a sort of random 10% of the time, then you can determine the probability that a certain number of users will all be active at the same time and find that you can support a lot more users. So there's a problem in the problem set that takes you through this analysis. Okay, it's sort of statistics. What is it? Math 360, probability 360, sort of ish problems. Okay, so we do about that. Okay, now, so the probability is that with 35 users, the probability is less than 0.004 that 10 are active at the same time. But what happens if more than 10 are active at the same time? Then we have congestion, right? And we have to deal with the fact that we have congestion. And depending on the kind of link that we're talking about, we may have congestion that causes queuing in the router that's attached there, or if we're talking about something like an Ethernet, we may actually have collisions on the Ethernet that cause trouble as well. So, okay. So, does it always win? No. not necessarily. The does it always win? No, in theory. Let's put it that way. No, in theory. But packet switching networks that are over-provisioned have sort of succeeded in taking over large fractions of the circuit switched business. And people who go into building networks that use circuit switching and building new technologies that use circuit switching are kind of losing. All right? The circuit switching has been very beneficial at the network core, where we map packet switching onto circuit switching for very busy links. But apart from that, the world of networking as we see it at the network edge is largely packet switching. Voice over IP, Netflix, YouTube, all that stuff, which 20 years ago people thought would require circuit switching, have ended up on packet switching. Okay, so that's the sort of core technology of the network. The next thing to talk about is this idea of internet, the idea that we hook a bunch of networks together to form a bigger network, and we call that an internet. We talked about this before, access ISPs. Earlier on, remember I said it said millions of hosts? Well, now I think they're getting the picture. Right? Now they're talking about millions of ISPs, and this is much more of much more like the word the world. There's going to be thousands of connected hosts with each ISP, essentially. How do we get them all connected together? Well, you certainly don't want to do that, right? That building the hardware for that's an n squared problem. N times n minus 1 over 2 links. Don't want to do that. Instead, what we do is connect into what's called a transit ISP, and then we make agreements about who has to pay for the costs associated with this. We send bills among all these folks, and we actually do it with competition, and then we peer between the peer, not as in looking, but as in peers. And what happens is that the way this is played out is that there get to be well-known established peering points. Certain buildings in certain cities become known as the place to be, where you can make an easy connection to your peers. It's a little bit scary in that there's these concentrations of important networking stuff in the basements of particular buildings. And in Seattle, there's I think it's close by the Westin Hotel. There's a place where this happens. I think there's one in Spokane. And so, you know, those become sort of prime targets for people who want to do ill in the world. But on the other hand, the whole point of the design of packet switching networks back when they were being created in the late 1960s was to build systems that would be robust in the face of essentially nuclear war. Okay? That was the worry at that time, and ARPA, the arm of the Defense Department that is called Advanced Research Projects Agency, sponsored a lot of research that led to the development of this packet switching technology. So, although each of these peering points is itself an attractive target, no one of those is in fact the only place that two networks can hook together. So this is a very robust configuration of the networks in terms of their ability to reroute traffic and on a very speedy time scale, right? You don't have, if this one goes away, or say if this link goes away, everybody is still connected, and there's lots of interconnectivity around the country. And the algorithms used in routing will figure that out quickly and fix it. Okay. It's complicated. You know, conceptually, this is not a complicated picture. What makes it complicated is people have to be paid. Right? Right? It costs a lot of money to build one of these things, and so if there's traffic going across it, you need to be paid for that. And the more people you're connected to, the more people you have to figure out how to bill for that capability. Oh, and then the other thing that happens is that this is new from the previous version of the textbook. Companies like Google and Microsoft and Akamai have, and Amazon have themselves built such large infrastructures and such distributed infrastructures that they will actually build their own networks, interconnecting their stuff, and then connect that into this at different places. Okay, so it becomes a business problem and not a technology problem, large. Okay, you can think of it as being hierarchical, but it's much messier than that. What does a tier one ISP look like? I don't know when this one was made, but you see that there are these are essentially fiber optic links that hook things together. A lot of links are actually done over circuit switched networks as well, but you don't see that from the outside. Okay, so that's sort of the big picture of how a big network, a worldwide network, is built. Let's talk a little bit more about delay, loss, and throughput. So, we've talked already about transmission latency, L over R. We also have queuing latency when things are in a queue. It takes a finite amount of time to send the packet currently being sent. Subsequent packets have to wait, and how long they have to wait depends on how many things are in front of them in the queue. Okay? There's a problem about this. Homework. If the buffers fill up, then we drop packets, and that causes loss. So here's the fundamental equation that you need to think about in sort of assessing how long it takes to do something in a network. The delay associated with each node that a packet passes through, tongue twister, is composed of four things. And we sort of start looking at this point and continue over to this point. So we look from the left edge of this one to the left edge of this one. Four things. The packet arrives here. We'll say it arrives when its last bit arrives. Okay? So now we have to do the process of figuring out what to do with that packet by looking at it. And that's called, that computational cost of figuring out what to do is called the processing delay associated with that step. Then it goes into potentially a queue behind other nodes, and that leads to the queuing delay. Once it gets to the head of the queue, it takes a certain amount of time to transmit it, L over R. Boom, out it goes. And then, if you think about what happens on a wire, right? Suppose what we do here is we make a voltage pulse. What happens to that voltage pulse? It takes a finite amount of time to move down the wire and come out the other end. Okay? That's the propagation time. Let's talk about the relative magnitude of these four things. Propagation delay. What's a sort of reasonable sort of order of magnitude estimate for propagation delay in wide area networks?
What?
On the first day of class, we calculated some things. Like we calculated how long it takes to for something to travel at two-thirds the speed of light across the country. So what was the...
25 milliseconds.
It was 25 milliseconds, right?
Yeah,
25 milliseconds. You know, most packets don't go that far, so they probably go... much shorter distance, but nevertheless, we're talking about numbers that are sort of on the order of milliseconds for that, right? Propagation delay. And some will be short. And if you're within a building, they will be much faster than that. It has to do with how far you go. But sort of that gives you mental picture, milliseconds. Transmission delay. Well, that very much depends on the length of your packets and the rate at which they're sent. So that, but if you think about it for sort of reasonable-ish link bandwidths, we're talking something that's sort of on the order of microseconds to milliseconds. Slower lengths will be slower. Faster links will be faster, but sort of tens of microseconds to milliseconds. Nodal processing. So think about what you have to do with an incoming packet. You have to look at where it's going, and you have to somehow look up in a table some information about that and make essentially an n-way decision where for a small n, the number of outgoing links, which one you're going to send it on. How long do you think that takes these days?
Microseconds.
Nanoseconds to microseconds, right? That's very fast. Okay, how about queuing delay? It completely depends on the size of the queue. Right? So it depends on the intensity of the traffic versus the outgoing link speed. Much less predictable than any of the other things. It could be many times the transmission delay, or it could be essentially zero, right? Because there's nobody there ahead of you. All right, so this poses a problem for writing exams and for taking exams, right? Is that if I ask you what's the nodal delay associated, what's a reasonable estimate of nodal delay associated with something because of this queuing thing, I don't know, you know, it depends. So, typically we frame the problems to ignore that in the sort of big picture questions and then ask questions about queuing delay separately. Okay? That's good. Typically less than a millisecond? Much shorter. Much faster these days. some things don't get updated, even though new editions of books and slides come out. Okay, so L over R, packet length over sending rate, propagation, D, the distance, over S, the speed. We've talked about how those are different, so make sure you know. How long does it take a caravan to get from the beginning of the first toll booth to the beginning of the second one? Takes 120 seconds. This is the transmission time, essentially, right? The toll booth takes 12 seconds, and there are 10 cars, so 10 seconds per car, 12 seconds, 120 seconds. We wait for the last car to propagate from the first toll booth, from this side of the toll booth to this side of this toll booth. 1 hour, 100 kilometers an hour. And so it takes 62 minutes, starting from here, to get over to here. And then you think about what happens if you suppose 1,000 kilometers an hour. I don't quite know what the point was there. I don't know. There's a homework problem that forces you through some of these sorts of analysis. Here's the level of queuing theory that we're going to talk about in this class. Suppose that we have packets of a certain length. We're going to assume they're all the same length. And we have an arrival rate, which is a certain number of packets per second. Right. So lengths are measured in bits. Arrival rates, A, are measured in what? Packets per second. If you multiply packets per second times bits per packet, what do you get?
Bits per second,
right? And so L times A here is something that's in bits per second. R, the rate, is something in bits per second. And when you divide the two, you get sort of the utilization that you're attempting to make of the link. It's a fraction. It's just a dimensionless fraction. Right? And the cool thing to know is that when the intensity, LA over R, is low, queuing is small. When the intensity approaches 1 for random arrival rates, for random arrival processes, the average queuing delay goes to infinity. Okay? That's for random arrival processes. If you have a deterministic arrival process that just says that you have LA over R equals 1, but you're doing it in a regular way, then, in fact, the queuing delay will not go to infinity. But almost all arrival processes are random in packet queuing networks. So what you got to realize is that you've got to keep the utilization down to keep the queuing delay down. Yes, and if the arrival rate exceeds the processing rate, then certainly the queuing will go to infinity, whether it's deterministic or not. Okay. And again, this is exacerbated by the modern penchant for having huge buffers, because the huge buffers will sort of actually let the queues sort of very much approximate infinity in the real world, and that leads to lots of delay. Okay, so to explore this, there's a homework problem that encourages you to use the traceroute program to find out get some sense of how long it takes for things to get across the internet. And it's on Windows, it's actually called TraceRT. So let's get out of here. May not be supported on this network. May be blocked. Unfortunately. Try one other thing. Okay. So, on Linux C machines, it's traceroute, R-O-U-T-E, and the switch -n tells it not to look up host names, and that will definitely speed up your experience of using it, although it will give you less idea of where things are going. On Windows, it turns out that it's minus D, it's traceRT, and that same switch is minus D. And it still doesn't work, and that's because it's probably being blocked on the WSU wireless network. So, but being blocked on the wireless network, but I bet it's not blocked over here. Let me quickly try something. No, it's probably not blocked over here, but what is blocked over here is any ability to get to a command window. So that's not going to help me. Let me think. Anything else I can do? Don't have that installed. Okay, I think I got one more trick up my sleeve. Let me try one more thing. How's our time? Almost out. All right, here we go. This will work.
This is kind of like checking through a coffee, right?
Kind of like. Yeah, all right. There we go.
So fast.
Very fast.
Wait, did it hit your home router twice? 33.5.
They're different things. Okay, so this is not my home machine. This is my office machine, and so it's on a WSU network, but it's not on the wireless network. And so, time to get to Google.com. And now Google.com actually turns into a whole bunch of different addresses all over the place, but this time, 193.349 was 9 milliseconds, and it went over 12 hops to get there. And if we get rid of that minus D, we will actually see that we will see more information, but it will take longer. And we'll see. Okay, yeah. So why three times? Why three columns? It tries three times at each distance. And so you can actually get situations, because remember, every packet is routed separately, you can get different paths for different packets, which is also interesting, makes interpreting this output challenging sometimes. But there you go. Right now it seems to be pretty stable, but we're not getting very good information about the names. Anyway, okay, so one of the homework problems has you using trace RT or trace route to do that. I want to show you the homework. Can I get there? Wrong. Don't go. We got a couple more minutes. Okay, back to here. So the chapter one problem set is posted. We'll turn it in on Angel. If you need to make diagrams or something, if you have a scanner, you could scan those in. But really, please do type your answers to the extent possible. You can hand draw the diagrams if you need to. If you don't have a scanner, photographs made by phones work just fine. Okay? So that'll work. Eileen? I'm going to post the slides. I've been remiss in getting that done. I intend to do it as soon as I get back to the office now. The other thing that I wanted to say is don't forget that the info assignment is due tonight, a picture and contact information. So please turn that in as well. Okay, so I'll see you Monday. Oh, yeah.